So I am here once again. We have T.C. Boyle, who is most recently the author of When the Killing's Done. Tom, how are you doing? It's always a pleasure to see you. You're looking quite dapper today.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. I'm a little under the weather.
Okay.
I have some kind of flu to start me off on my tour, but by God, I'm fighting it back.
Yes.
With my powerful immune system.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and dope you up with whatever's necessary when the conversation starts, so to speak. But I wanted to start off, because we didn't talk about Wild Child, I wanted to see if we could tie in that to this book. The discussion in question 62, reminiscent of some of the dialogue that is surrounding the Atacapa rats and the Santa Cruz pigs. Bulletproof, you have this school meeting, and you have all these agitated opinions, which is similar to the Alma LaJoy showdown in When the Killing's Done. 1,300 rats, of course, and if I wanted to make a sort of a weaker connection, you could talk about how Wild Child's rather feral tone is almost there in the opening of this book with Beverly. And then, of course, there's the story, Anacapa, a fishing expedition gone awry. So this leads me to ask you if some of these stories serve almost as prototypes isn't the word I want to use, but maybe early efforts of honing the narrative framework that you might actually use to build a bigger house of a novel.
What a great question. None of this had occurred to me in the slightest bit, by the way.
Okay.
I know that all the work is thematically linked, and this is what I'm interested in, but I hadn't really thought of it in that way. With one exception, the story Anacapa. I wasn't quite ready to begin this novel yet, even the research for it, but
yeah.
I knew that I was going to do it. And it was at the end of the last story writing phase, and Anacapa is the last of those stories. Of course, the first section of the new novel is called Anacapa, too, about the same island. Totally different, but the same island. So I was aware of that connection, but I really hadn't thought of the others. But you make a good point. The question 62 is similar in terms of its question as to who has the ethical right to control other creatures, whether they be human beings or animals.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if stories have in the past serve as a way for you to spin an early narrative theme before...
Not that I'm aware of specifically, but again, it takes a reader, a good reader, like yourself, to see those connections. You know, it's so interesting. You're absolutely right, I'm sure, that some of the concerns in those stories are then writ large in a novel like When the Killing's Done. And that really, I don't really work in that way, though. Our stories just happen, and once they're done, I forget entirely about them.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there's a lot of fruitful material for these kind of connections to be made in throughout my work. I'm aware of that, but I don't really force it or worry about it or think about it. I'm just going on to do what comes next.
Well, how much of your work do you actually remember now that we've come down to this? I mean,
this book was delivered in July of 2009.
Yeah.
I am two-thirds of the way through the next novel, and that was preceded by one half of the next book of stories.
So
what is the next novel? San Miguel. While doing research for this, I found some historical stories connected with the farthest island out, San Miguel. Incidentally, as you know from this, Santa Cruz Island, four times bigger than Manhattan. Nobody lives on it. The 10% on the eastern end is owned by the National Park Service. The rest is the Nature Conservancy, to be given eventually to the Park Service. There's a small campground that the Park Service maintains there, and I'm told by the ranger that in summer, they might get as many as 900 people a weekend camping there. San Miguel, 900 a year. It's out there. It's bleak. The wind is blowing. It's the top island, so everything is going around Point Conception there and whipping down from the north and blowing across.
Yeah.
Anyway, this one is very different. I'm just trying it as an experiment. It's straightforward historical narrative, sans irony, just to see if I can do that. And so far, I guess I am.
Mm-hmm. What about Santa Rosa, the most populated of the four?
Santa Rosa, as the most populated, might have like 10 people on it.
Yeah.
The Vale Vickers families have owned that concession on that island for many, many years. The Park Service is taking it over as of this year. they had to have removed all the animals. They had imported elk for hunting, and they ran a hunting concession. I believe those animals are being sold off to hunters now, and that, I'm not sure of this, but I believe the Vail family is able to stay on in their house there for a while, but eventually that's all national park as well.
But nothing really there to offer a sort of launching pad for fiction. It's the island you won't write about? Or?
No.
It seems natural to complete the set, you know
what
I mean?
It is. Well, yeah, well, there are eight of the islands.
Yeah, so there I go. Well, there you go, yeah.
I've never really done a sequel or a series or anything else, and this is not that. This novel is utterly different in its approach and its concerns. It's only about the environment in a marginal way. It's more about isolation. And another one of the themes that I love is individuals getting away from society and forming a smaller society and trying to make that work, as in Drop City and The Road to Wellville and various other books.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to get to some of the interesting ideological conflicts, but I wanted to first of all remark on something that was rather interesting to me. Hair in this book. I have not read a book in the last 3 years that featured such prodigious descriptions of hair. I want to actually name a few. Yes.
My God, I hadn't even realized.
No, I mean, it's so incredible. You have Anise's hippie hair, of course, extending down to her feet.
Oh, yes, well, that's very important.
Yes.
That hair is hugely important.
Yes, an expanding mushroom cloud of kinked out hair, you describe it at one point. You have Toni Walsh, she's left her hair loose and the wind takes hold of it, flinging it across her face. You have Rita, her hair hung limp for lack of shampoo. Thatch had one of those layered cuts the hair bands favored to distract you from the fact that they couldn't play their instruments.
God, that's beautiful.
Who
wrote that?
I don't know. Alma entering the docksider, her hair flying out behind her like a deflated parachute. Cammy, before you describe her as having the look of someone who knows a whole lot more than she's revealing, which I think is a very telling description, before you do that, you describe that she has her hair kinked out to her shoulders. And I said to myself, I have not read a novel like this. That
you know,
is
you're
so
absolutely
fixated
right.
With hair.
Maybe we, in the paperback version, we'll call it Hair 2.
Yes.
What do you think?
Absolutely. No, but why do you think that hair was such a great descriptive focal point?
Well, I could say something like, this is about sheep shearing, and so hair is a natural element. But no, I have no idea. That's just the way it came.
Yeah.
But it's very important to folk singer that she should have this hair, though. That's essential. But the others, I don't know. They just happen to have hair.
Is it a sort of carryover from the sort of wild-maned wild child, or perhaps just the fact that...
God.
I get the sense that...
I don't know, Ed. It just happens.
No, but you really like, I think, to write about women. And I think in the last two novels in particular, you've been perhaps more concerned with the description of women than men. And so I wonder why. Are you a hair man? I guess.
That's a great.
You're Bill Clinton here, basically. Yeah.
It's a great thing. I am moving unconsciously in my work, and I don't really know what's happening, except that it's all connected in some way and what my interests are in retrospect. However, I am aware that in the beginning of my career, I didn't write much about women or from the perspective of women. Women were sort of incidental in things like Water Music and World's End and so on. The first woman main character was Ruth Dershowitz in East is East. Since then, though, since I haven't written so much about women, I am aware that lately I'm writing a great deal from women's point of view. Dana in Talk, for instance, in this book. And the one I'm writing now has three sections, and each is from the point of view of a woman.
Yeah.
No male perspective at all.
Huh.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just playing something out and trying to do something I haven't done or finding new territory by doing this. However, I'm already making a promise to myself, and I'll make it to you, that the next one after this is going to be a male point of view, and it's going to be absolute wild-ass black humor, back to the fur growing out of the mouth kind of stories I used to write.
Yeah,
shake it up. You have to keep shaking up and try to do something different.
Well, on the subject of women, do you think that writing The Inner Circle may have led you to sort of be more, I guess, gender equal in your fiction at all? Or?
I don't know. I mean, again, you can only look at it in retrospect. I guess so. But, wow. Each story is different, and each story has a different valence, and it takes off in its own direction. You mentioned question 62. You know, we have two women, women's perspective, and no male perspective in that.
Or maybe it's your way of ensuring that you still have readers in this sort of plummeting book age.
I were calculating, boy, that's for sure. Yeah. We know that no man has ever bought a book and never will ever again. So yeah, maybe I'm barking up the right tree here. This is great.
Yeah. Okay.
Tell me more. Women, come to me. I embrace you.
I wanted to actually talk about some of the closeness to fact in this book. In 2001, an organization called Fun for Animals did manage to temporarily stop the National Park Service.
I'll interrupt you, yes.
Yes.
This is all based on actual incidents that occurred as reported in the news. The characters I've invented are purely inventions. I'd never met the people involved. All I know is what I read in news accounts. So they're invented from what I heard in the news. For instance, you know, on my refrigerator door is the headline from the news press that says, eagles arrive as pigs are killed.
Yes.
And the Dave LaJoy is based on the guy who's called the Rat Savior.
Yes.
Who invented his own animal group, and I just changed the names and changed the circumstances. But it's essentially true. This actually happened in the past decade.
Essentially true, because it is interesting to me that you have Dave LaJoy, who is essentially an angry, violent, Xanax-popping megalomaniac. You're very good at these megalomaniacs.
I wonder why.
But what's interesting is, like, you've given Alma, for example, the vegetarianism. You have the incident with the squirrel. And it's interesting that you're kind of stacking the deck, because I did hear you on the takeaway this morning, and you're saying, well, readers are taking sides here. Mm-hmm. This reader did not actually take sides. I actually was curious about the nuances of both ideologies here.
Good. And the way it should be. And yeah. I don't want to, you know, the woman on the show this morning was asking me to, well, where do you stand? I don't want to say that because it ruins the book for people. You know, I shouldn't be saying anything. They can see it as they will. What is interesting about the several reviews I've seen so far is that some of the reviewers are taking sides. One, in fact, weighed it in the way that you have weighed it and said, you know, that LaJoy, for all of his problems, is right, you know? So I find that wonderful and fascinating. And further, Alma and LaJoy are the same sort of person to a degree, not mentally, not in terms of emotions, but in terms of what they believe in.
But LaJoy is such an incredibly intense presence. I mean, you give him two scenes where he's just remarkably rude and remarkably pugnacious, and the kind of guy that if, you know, he tried that to me, well, we'd have some words, right? You know, it's almost as if there's intensity combined with the fact that he is this high-end stereo salesman almost stacks the deck that animal rights is more extreme than, say, the Alma position. And so I'm wondering if, in your effort to find balance, there's something slightly tilted more in LaJoy's favor in terms of extremity, because, or maybe that's just something that perhaps you can't help being a rather exuberant writer. What of this? I mean, are you aware of the balance between the two extremes here and finding these nuances?
No. We've talked often enough, Ed, that you know how I work. I work instinctively, day by day, and make leaps as far as theme and plot and characterization as I move along. It's not so theoretical as you might think. So I don't really worry about that. I just create the scenes and the drama and let it play out.
Well, to what degree do you sympathize with an animal rights activist?
A great deal. As I say, I mean, I can't even look at the PETA videos of the slaughterhouses. You know, I mean, it's horrifying to me.
Yeah. I mean, did you channel any of that empathy in LaJoy? I mean, how did you do that, out of curiosity? I mean, did you watch any PETA videos to sort of understand why he would be so enraged?
Any novelist will say that, you know, he or she is drawing on some of his own personality and in creating these characters who have many, many traits. And I suppose both Alma and Dave are parts of my own personality. You know, the violent, domineering, egomaniacal part without compromise. Both share that. There is no compromise. There's no right and wrong. There's only my way. Both of them share that. But also the more reasoned scientific approach that Alma brings to the same issue. They both love animals. They both want to save animals and the environment.
Yeah. I wanted to remark upon a recent essay by Diane Johnson, the New York Review of Books. I'm sure you've probably seen it by now.
Yes, I have.
But she wrote something that I happen to agree with, which is, because his sense of the ridiculous usually overcomes his moments of gravity, he rarely departs from a comic mode that precludes tears, even in the most tragic circumstances. I think that this is a fair point, especially in this book. But if your book is informed with this sense of the ridiculous, I'm wondering if this is going to impede upon writing in more serious or graver turf. I mean,
it might, which is precisely why I'm doing a non-comic, straightforward historical narrative right now, just to see how that might be and what might happen. Don't forget, I'm the guy who wrote Water Music as my first novel, to turn the historical novel on its head and subvert it and pull the rug out and nudge you constantly about the unreliability of fiction and of history too. Now, I am trying to write something without any irony or any comedy. Straightforward drama, straightforward realism, just because I've never done it before. I've done it in short stories, but I've never done it at length. And I found this wonderful story, a historical story, which I'm telling as best I can. We shall see what the results are. In fact, if we're very lucky, you and I will be sitting here in 2 years discussing that one, and we'll find out.
Well, maybe we do. But I want to see if we can get to When the Killing's Done and this problem of adopting the comic exuberant tone. I mean, I think this book does really present some very important issues that we were alluding to earlier about, well, how does humanity play God with the animal kingdom? I mean, this is a very serious topic. I mean, and the comedy is almost a mask over something that is, well, if you think about it, from either side, really depressing. So I'm wondering if, in not permitting us to share tears, as Diane Johnson believes, it almost trivializes the issue to some degree, or if it presents a problem, or is your strategy more of like laying a few comic exuberant bombs to blow off in the reader's head, like in about a week or so?
Wow. Neither of the above. I'll go for choice C. I don't see this as necessarily a comic novel. Certainly, there are many varieties of comedy, of course, and I've used every possible mode I can think of. This has its moments, of course, and I think it allows the reader to stand back at times and view the characters with some kind of ironic detachment, perhaps. But I don't see this as essentially a comic novel. I see this as a dramatic novel. And further, and we've talked about this in the past, I often find that using the comic mode can be more emotionally wrenching than writing a straightforward drama, because it subverts your expectations.
Yeah.
And in this one, you know, look at the ending of this book. It should punch you right in the heart, you know? I hope it does.
But, I don't know, from my standpoint, it read very much like a comic novel to me. I mean, particularly every time LaJoy came up. I mean, this guy is just such a really
because
hilarious...
Because he's exaggerated to a degree, and yet... he's also real. and I wouldn't want to say that, as I said earlier, that he represents a large part of me, but certainly that part is there. And certainly, Ed, we are, both of us, pretty much perfect and beautifully emotionally adjusted, but a lot of people out there are not.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who make LaJoy look calm, you know?
Yeah. I also want to remark on the role of literature in this book. It's not in very good shape. It was something I detected that I don't think a lot of readers are going to, but Alma remembers Madame Bovary in the genre noir original. You have a few quick references to Jack London's To Build a Fire, but nobody really seems to understand it. Anise's early days, you have her mother Rita is fretting about this 2595 studies in the American story, where you have Star Wars a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away versus Bartleby's, which we'd prefer not to. And then Anise can't quite get the hang of Island of the Blue Dolphins later in the timeline and earlier in the book. The sense I'm getting here is that if literature is meant to inform these choices, to prevent these kind of ideological dichotomies, well, based off of the world you offer here, it's not in very good shape. But that's an inherently pessimistic position.
Oh, I don't know if you're reading too much into it or not, Ed. These literary references are meant to, or are, I don't know if they're meant, I can't say they're meant, they happen to identify the characters to some degree, whether they get it or not. And it's also a marker for the reader to make a kind of assessment. By the way, Island of the Blue Dolphins, I had to tell the story in a page or so. My children had to read it in school. You know, it's very popular in the West Coast because of the islands off the coast, which nobody else in the world knows about, you know?
Yeah.
What a great story. And I resent the late Scott O'Dell for having written it, even if it is a YA novel. I don't care. I wanted to tell that story at length. It's my wild child, you know? It's another wild child story. It fascinates me. Feral man, primitive man, being alone in nature. All of this is so remarkable.
Yeah. Even if it is a YA novel, you're sort of
it's superb.
Staring down at the idea of a YA novel or genre there.
It's superb. It's great. I love it so much. And I'm glad it's a YA novel because it doesn't threaten me as much because I don't write YA novels. But God, what a great story. And I wish he hadn't written it so that I could have. So anyway, I had to reference it and had to tell the story in just a page or so to remind everybody about it.
It was suggested in the Diane Johnson thing, I don't think we quite answered this question, that you're writing the comic voice is almost putting upon a mask towards what you've declared as an inherent pessimism. I mean, I listened to your little 15-minute interview with Silverblatt recently, and you pointed out that you were most at peace when you were going for your long walks, and even though you could see the bark being dissolved by the beetle being eroded, you still could marvel at that nature, but essentially you're almost taking off the reality of the fact that here is the world around us dissolving. And I'm wondering to what degree the comic tone of these walks serve as a kind of way for you to, I suppose, live with your pessimism, or is it possible that you're overstating your pessimism? Do you have anything that you feel optimistic or joyful about?
No.
No, nothing optimistic, huh?
No. Since I discovered death at a very young age, it has obsessed me. And the whole purpose of our endeavors obsesses me. And in a larger scale, of course, our human endeavors on the planet, which will, of course, be burned to a cinder in 3.5 billion years anyway, so what does anything matter, etc. As I probably have said to you before, you know, I went from being a Roman Catholic boy with God in his heaven and Santa Claus at the age of 11 or 12 or whatever, realizing that it's all completely phony and it's just some myth that we've been fed to make us, to prevent us from committing suicide at a young age. And within 3 or 4 years of that, I was thrust into the lap of the existentialists, and I've never come back.
Then is work really the only way, the only reason to stay alive?
All work is irrelevant, everything is irrelevant, our conversation is irrelevant, literature is irrelevant, films, love, everything is utterly irrelevant in the face of utter meaninglessness and death. That's what we live with, everybody lives with, everybody, every minute of every day. On the other hand, if you're not going to shoot yourself tonight, do what satisfies you. What satisfies me is making literature and then sitting here with you and talking about it.
So,
and also, I mean, I have honor, I mean, I really believe in the power of literature, and I like to promote it. I don't. I've never cheated anybody or hurt anybody. You know, that sort of thing. And that's simply because that's my own code. It doesn't make me any better or worse than Jeffrey Dahmer, for instance. You know, it's just
who's dead.
A point of existence.
Yeah. Well, then, if everything is irrelevant, is there a certain comfort in things being irrelevant? Of not finding any lofty meaning?
There's a kind of comfort, and I think environmentalists take it too, in knowing that, all right, I'll be dead, but so will everybody else. On the other hand, we're part of a continuing culture, and how long it will last, we can't say. But as part of it, we may feel, I do anyway, an obligation to extend it And beyond that, to try to preserve what is left of the environment, it is, of course, hopeless. We're coming up on 7 billion people, as Alma keeps saying.
Yeah.
But more and more, I think you have to live in the moment and do what satisfies you. Now, of course, this is sort of the philosophy of the misfit of Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man is Hard to Find. If there is goodness and there is reason, a reason for being, then in his case, you should follow Jesus and be a Christian. If there's not, then there's nothing but meanness in the world, and you may as well hurt anybody every way you possibly can.
Yeah. But spirituality does not have to be tied into religion or ideology. It could be tied into some individual quest that isn't necessarily grouped with
yes,
any other...
Yes, whatever satisfies you.
Yeah.
And my quest is to make art and... also to feel that pulse, you know, of nature. I had a driver this morning, and he lives, I don't know where he lives, in Brooklyn or someplace, and he likes to get upstate once in a while and go out hunting in the woods. Hallelujah, you know? I mean, I like to be in the woods just to feel something greater than myself and have peace and tranquility, which of course you need in order to make literature and to write literature and to read literature.
Yeah.
And I find that that is a great solace.
You need to be humbled then by nature.
I suppose. Yeah, I suppose so. To be a creature in nature without worrying about all the things we're talking about, the destruction of the environment and so on, to put that out of your mind.
Yeah.
Of course, I do come upon the old clear cuts in the forest, and that makes me crazy, or the trash thrown by the huge fat people on their snowmobiles in the winter, which gets them miles out into the woods where they can never walk on their own, but then I have to walk out there and pick it up because it's an offense to me.
Yeah, but I'm curious how these pilgrimages allow you to take in what is going on in the world. I mean, Wisconsin, Libya. I mean, right now it's an extraordinarily pessimistic time. One can get lost in all the driftwood of really unpleasant developments.
You know, one thing, Ed, and I'm sure everybody does this to a larger or smaller degree, I shut things out that I'm not interested in. Bad reviews, I don't read them. People don't like me, I don't pay any attention to them. Something's happening, some crisis somewhere that I cannot affect, I try to ignore it. Not to say that I'm not interested in the world at large. It's just that there's too much. There's way too much. And, you know, I want to put a Band-Aid on everything. As I said before, I worry about everything throughout the whole world. It's not fruitful. It's not productive. It is to address in art and try to explore my own feelings about things. It's a very selfish pursuit, actually, being an artist.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that the society allows me to do it.
Yeah, but if art is not the panacea to these problems, does it allow someone to pick up the threads of what you've done or what I've done or what anybody has done?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
I think so, and also a book like When the Killing's Done, for instance, or The Tortilla Curtain, it dramatizes an issue and shows it from deep point of view of characters who are opposed. I think readers can derive some kind of benefit from this, as they can from any great literature, simply by expanding their own view. Whichever side they come down on, all right, you know, but with The Tortilla Curtain, for instance, about illegal immigration, when I was first researching the book, there were two points of view current in Los Angeles, yes and no.
Yeah.
But there was no middle ground and no thought what the other side might feel or what the other side's arguments were. And I'm not writing a political novel in that book or in this one either. I'm simply exploring a situation or an issue.
I wanted to ask about the geography of Anacapa and Santa Cruz. I mean, you're careful to sometimes be kind of general in your descriptions, but more often than not, I think you offer more of an aerial point of view. For example, with Prisoner's Harbor, you describe it from the air as if it were a big dun plesiosaur stretching out its blocky head in pursuit of some swift-finned creature of the deep. The question I have is, how many of these points did you actually physically walk? Were you allowed to step foot in all of these particular areas? I mean, they're little points on the map as one reads the novel. There's the helpful map at the very beginning, and I kept wondering if you had actually hit, how much of this turf you had actually hit.
My mother-in-law who for most of her life viewed me as some kind of crazed beast. If she were visiting us and I would come down to breakfast, she would spring up from the chair and say, "My God, does he sit here?" She's come to more of an accommodation with me as she's gotten older. And she always says to me, "You are very, very lucky." And I thought, well, lucky, you know, I work hard. But she's absolutely right. I am very, very lucky just to be here in one piece and to be able to make art. And so here is how my luck has extended even further. I got to meet several of the biologists, and I got to go out onto Santa Cruz Island and go with them on their expeditions and stay out there overnight, where, by the way, the sky is black and there is no sound of human activity whatsoever, and nobody else. You know, you're on an island bigger than Manhattan, and there is absolutely nobody there except you. It's pretty cool. And I got to see a large part of the island. Again, there's a good extent to it, and it takes a long while to get from one end to the other.
Yeah. Did you actually traverse the entire end by foot?
Oh, no. No, no, no. I didn't have enough time.
Yeah, okay.
By vehicle, on a dirt road.
Got it.
Because some of the roads, they, as you know from the book, they wash out all the time, and they have a bulldozer, the Nature Conservancy, to plow them out. Because there were once roads for the sheeping operations on Christie Ranch on the far western end. Is an old broken-down ranch house from the past, but they would have to communicate. It was all owned by Cary Stanton at one time, that whole part of the island. And it wasn't operating a ranch until the mid-80s.
So did you check out a lot of the abandoned shacks of previous ranchers and the like? Or?
There aren't a lot of abandoned shacks, but yes, I did check out what is left. There's the old ranch house at Scorpion, which is now a Park Service building. There is the beautifully preserved main house at the main ranch, which is where Cary Stanton lived, which he gave to the Nature Conservancy, who will eventually give it to the Park Service. That is high-end and highly maintained and very beautiful. That's where the big vineyard used to be in the turn of the last century. And then there's the remains of the Christie Ranch on the far end. And that's about it. On this huge thing, again, four times bigger than Manhattan.
Did you do this level of psychogeography for any of your previous novels out of curiosity, or?
Drop City.
Yeah.
When I went up to Alaska for a month, I knew that it would be set around Fairbanks, so I focused on that, but I ranged widely for my own interest, not knowing what would go in the novel. And the best stuff I found, which was only alluded to, really was on the Kobuk River. And this one, I think, if you're asking about geographic location, so few people know about the Channel Islands. When I first mentioned it to Deborah Treisman at the fiction editor of The New Yorker that I was working on the Channel Islands, she assumed I was talking about the English Channel Islands, as many people do. So not only did I feel obligated to give a sense of what they are and where they are, but I also asked Paul to put this map in the front so that people could get a sense of it themselves.
Yeah. Well, then going back to...
I mean, even in Santa Barbara,
You
know, a lot of people don't know about it. And you can see them. There they are, 22 miles away.
What do you think accounts for their anonymity?
It's a very rough channel, as you've seen in the book. And it's hard to get out there. Unless you're a sailor, you know. Or you take the boat. There's a regular boat service. The Park Service takes you out there. You go to Scorpion and you can camp out overnight if you like.
Yeah.
Takes maybe an hour and a half to get there. Well, I'm going to go over the rail, of course. Very rough water, usually. And you can stay for 4 hours on a day trip and then come back on the boat again. I've done that several times, but I've also had the pleasure of staying overnight a couple of times as well. Several times.
Uh-huh. Now, I wanted to actually ask Fraser, the 46-year-old New Zealand island healer, with the flask. He brings up the concept of the Judas pig. And the Judas pig is a radio-collared female pig that draws a bunch of the males, and then bing, bang, bing, bing, bye-bye pigs. I found a paper by two Australians, Trudy Sharp and Glenn Saunders of the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, on the Judas pig, but I couldn't find any indicators that the Judas pig idea was used by the New Zealanders who, you know, worked on the Channel Islands. So I'm wondering if that was a situation where there was parallel research going on for you, or did they in fact use the Judas pig?
As far as I know, they did.
Uh-huh.
The creation of Frasier is interesting. I was put in touch with the actual New Zealish guy who really wanted to talk and get together and talk about it. I finally chose not to because I didn't want to come too close to representing some actual person whom I actually knew. So I completely invented him from just reading newspaper accounts and so on. And there is somewhere in that literature the fact that they did use the Judas pigs and so on. Wow. Yeah, I don't want anybody to be recognizable as an actual person, but sometimes you come close. I don't know where he actually was like.
Yeah.
However, when I did do the confrontation scene at the lecture, Lotus Vermeer, who's become a good friend and who runs the Nature Conservancy there, said that she had nightmares from reading it because it was exactly like what had happened to her.
And you hadn't, of course, ascended it.
I hadn't been there. Yeah. I had only read about it in the newspaper. But, you know, this is what a novelist is supposed to do, I think. Or at least my type of novelist. I'm sure if I were Tom Wolfe, you know, I would have gone to every meeting and so on. And I don't necessarily want to. I want to know my facts, and I want to have a good, clear picture of things. I don't necessarily want to reproduce them in a journalistic way, though, because it interferes with my dream and my purpose, which is to be free-flowing and improvisational.
Yeah, and yet there's a few times where Boyle the historian, that's what I called it, shows up and starts outlining the history.
I felt I had to, again, yeah. Because this area is so little known to everybody, let alone in the United States, but all over the rest of the world where the book will be published. They have no idea, no concept. So I did feel obligated to do that, and I think the historical aspect, which you get in these set pieces, and then in that one section where I'm telling who was who and
sure.
In the past, I felt it was necessary to give it some weight and moment, so you kind of realize that this is not a new situation.
In terms of the similarity of certain events with fictitious events, did Penguin Legal, were they on you in any capacity?
Nope, or? No one said a word.
Huh.
I would presume, I hope, that I'm in the clear. What I've used and relied heavily on are the books that I mentioned in the beginning, and they are memoirs and histories of the area, and I read probably 10 of them, and then a lot of unpublished stuff, too, at the Santa Cruz Island Foundation. And Marla Daly, who runs that, is amazing, an amazing historian. And the rest from newspaper accounts. And the only people I actually knew of this were a couple of the biologists. And that's it. Everything else is invented from history and newspaper accounts.
Why do you think that this combination of dutiful research, dutiful reading plus imagination, it was, at least in the case of this woman who basically said, oh my God, I had nightmares, more real than, say, the Wolfian talk to every single individual, including the waiter who overheard the conversation? I mean,
I don't know if it's more real or less real. It's just a different way of working.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've never been a journalist. I've never dealt with it in that way.
Was there ever a period where you worried about adhering close to the facts in the early stuff? Or?
Yeah, of course. I do adhere close to the facts. But the facts, you know, there's a little disclaimer in Water Music, my first novel, which my editor of the time, Peter Davison, asked me to include so that, you know, there wouldn't be debates in historical societies about fine points. And I talked about, and I can't quote it from memory, but I talked, it's beautifully phrased, by the way. I talked about the fact that this is based on Mungo Park's, you know, journals and the actual truth of his expeditions. But that where the facts interfere with the exigencies of fiction, I have no qualms about subverting them and creating new things. I remember in Riven Rock, people asked me, how do you know that the relationship between Stanley McCormick and Catherine Dexter was never consummated? And the answer is very simple, because I wrote the novel.
Yeah. Sure.
But actually, my research led me to believe that that was the case.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, to what degree is steering off of the facts more? I mean, you mentioned, we were talking earlier about the difference between comic tone and straight drama, straight tragedy, that one gives you more liberation than the other. Is it the same when you have pre-existing facts that you're inventing from versus just outright fabrication? Are there advantages to that as well? Or?
Each has its moment. If you look at the short stories, for instance, which would be a better way of analyzing this, you know, maybe there's 150 stories out there or more. And they're in every mode, every voice, every possible thing I could ever conceive of, because why not?
Yeah.
And in some cases, they're pure invention. In some cases, they have some autobiographical material. In some cases, they're surreal. In some cases, they're realistic. Some, they've been suggested by something at actual events or actual historical characters. It's all the same to me. It's a way of doing a riff, you know? I'm just doing a riff on history, on character, on language, on subjects, themes.
Got it. Well, Dave LaJoy at one point calls Home Depot the most anonymous place in the world, which is not only a funny joke, but also kind of interesting in light of the fact that he can't view these islands as the most anonymous place in the world. I'm curious as to how that came about. Did you go to Home Depot and deal with the daytime drunks and that kind of thing at any point, or was it just a
cop to having been to Home Depot.
Yeah.
But in general, all of those places terrify me, you know, because of the consumerism that fuels our entire economy, and which, of course, has to end in a bust because we have finite resources.
Yeah.
It terrifies me. I don't buy much ever. I don't like buying anything. I have everything, but I don't want to go buy it. By the way, I only want what I already have. So here's my new red sneakers, you know, because the old ones wore out.
Yeah, I did see those.
My wife goes and buys stuff for me. She's the main consumer in our house. But I don't like it, and I don't have time to go and buy things. I don't want to buy. The only thing I buy is groceries and gardening stuff, you know, a bag of steer manure, you know.
So how often do you leave the house aside from these walks, then?
When I'm in a writing phase and not in a touring phase, when I'm on the mountain writing, I always begin and end books on the mountain if I can, and that's going to be the case with the one I'm working on now if all works out.
Yeah.
I'm leading a good life. If I make dinner, if I actually cook dinner, I know I'm having a good, quiet, calm life. So how often? I don't know. I'm leading a fairly balanced life when I'm home and writing, not when I'm on tour all the time, which can be very draining, especially when you factor in the European parts of it. I will go a couple of days maybe without going anywhere other than for walks.
The mountain, so every single book pretty much has been finished
lately.
Lately. Okay.
Begun and finished up there because it's so isolated and it's boring. But it's a good kind of boring. It's a kind of boring that makes you work harder because you're bored. And there is a society up there. I used to be fairly anonymous up there, but now, of course, amongst the 28 year-round denizens, of course, I'm a good friend. And a lot of drinking goes on up there, by God, and I get swept into it. Another wonderful thing is I have very close friends up there, all of whom are the kind of people I would never meet in normal life.
So really, it's there's a certain anonymity here that is fueled inside by your writing and your life that the mountain actually kind of fills that need, I suspect.
I don't know. The way that I was raised as a baby boomer with my parents and my friends and their parents, we got a good education, but no one ever told us no. And so this has been my whole life. I just do exactly as I please, and I don't have to. I've been very, again, my mother-in-law said I'm lucky. I don't have to deal with anything I don't want to deal with and can choose to do exactly what I want. I don't want to go to fancy ski resorts. I don't want to be seen here and there. I don't want to be at the charity ball. I just want to do exactly what I'm going to do. And so my mountain is a place that nobody knows about. It's interesting. Here I am in love with this place more than any place I've ever been in my whole life. And it is south of Mineral King and south of Yosemite. I've never been to either of those places and probably never will be, because I've got my own mountain where nobody knows me and nobody bugs me except the locals.
Yeah.
And that's the way I want it.
Tom, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
As always, Ed, but I can't shake your hand. Don't forget, because you might catch the disease. And this was a wicked one, boy. Holy Christ.